It's very good indeed to be back here in this wonderful church again. Thank you so much for your invitation and for your welcome. Well, as you know, this is the final address in this year's Lenten series, New Reformations? And tonight our theme is wisdom. But please don't assume that because this sermon brings the series to an end, somehow wisdom is going to supply a summing up, a full stop. Far from reaching watertight conclusions, it's more in the nature of biblical wisdom to identify and ask the right questions and to model good ways of asking them. And that's really all that I can try to do tonight. But how important that task is, because it goes right to the heart of the Church of England's identity that owes so much to the Reformation. I'm not simply thinking about the questions of authority, church polity, and sacramental theology that dared to be asked 500 years ago. We must ask the questions of today as a church that is constantly in search of reformation in every generation. As the 16th century tag had it, the legacy of our history is not simply to have been reformed, but to be constantly in the process of being reformed. Reformata atque semper reformanda. So let me ask, to begin with, what it means to be wise according to the scriptures. And I then want to raise some of the challenges facing our church today where I believe wisdom is very much needed. In our reading from the book of Proverbs, the characteristics of the wise man or woman are set out. To be wise is to respond to the invitation of a gracious lady whom the text calls Lady Wisdom. She walks the street, calls out from the heights, stands at the crossroads, takes up her position at the town gate. She is in every public place where men and women go out and in, where choices are made about which way to go, where leaders gather to transact business, where the young congregate to learn and shape their lives. To you, O people, I call, learn prudence, acquire intelligence. Hear, for I shall speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right. And she goes on to describe the treasures she has to offer to those who listen. Wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you desire cannot compare with her. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and prosperity. Now, if we look into these first nine chapters of the book of Proverbs, we glimpse what wisdom means. It has many different levels. We learn how to manage our households well, what we call oikonomia, from which we get the word economy. We learn about shrewdness, common sense, speaking well, having good judgment, being prudent with our resources. We learn the virtues of hard work, careful speech, living purposefully, finding fulfillment in being diligent, becoming aware of other people and the environment we live in. We learn how to know ourselves better, understand the ambiguities and contradictions of our flawed human nature. We learn where to find happiness and how to avoid misery. We learn about our own creatureliness, how we live in a morally ordered universe where creation can teach us and where destinies are set. And we learn that wisdom is fundamentally a religious quality whose source and end are God himself. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and to know the Holy One is insight. In all this, I think there's one overriding message, that the goal of the wise man or woman is to become a human being who is aware, emotionally, spiritually, physically, practically, theologically. And we could call this the quality of being present to God, to one another, to the world, and to ourselves, being present. When the Church Father Irenaeus said that the glory of God is a human being fully alive, I think this is what he meant. To be wise, to be aware, to be intelligent in all these dimensions of living, to practice mindfulness, as we say nowadays, all these are symptoms, synonyms, for the God-given wisdom that, says Proverbs, makes us fully alive, fully human. As the New Testament says, Jesus himself is the embodiment, the very incarnation, the perfect realization of divine wisdom. Now, there's a special emphasis on leadership in the wisdom literature. And some scholars think that books like Proverbs were compiled precisely to contribute to the education of future leaders, especially young men in the royal court. Witness repeated phrases like, "Listen, my child," throughout the book. In our own day, leadership training in the church and in secular institutions of many kinds has enthusiastically taken up the phrase reflective practitioner to characterize what it means to lead well. The thinking is that people, communities, and institutions need more than anything to become self-aware, conscious of who and what they are, and how they need to be in wholesome relationships, both personally and collectively. And you only create healthy communities by leading them in healthy ways. And this is where I want to warm to the main part of my address. Because if the church is to become intelligent, reflective, generous, engaged, self-aware, compassionate, prudent, virtuous, and wise, if indeed it is going to reflect the character of the God who is all these things, then it must be led by those who are formed in these ways too. I'm not saying that no institution is better than its leaders, but the values by which leaders live are profoundly influential in shaping the communities they're responsible for. In the church, the ordinal spells this out carefully, reminding clergy that to be responsible under God for the household of faith is an awesome vocation indeed. And these were some of the themes I explored 10 years ago in the book Wisdom and Ministry, which the rector has just waved in front of you, but which it would be terrible self-interest of me to promote, but you can get it on Amazon. Now, I can't recall a time when the leadership of our church was under so much public scrutiny as it is now. We feel for the House of Bishops who need the wisdom of Solomon in responding to the challenges that they're faced with. But scrutiny is good for us. It reminds us of our accountability. I'm going to come to two specific challenges shortly, but let me first say something about my own experience as a recently retired priest and how it's made me think about the Church of England's role in the modern world. I retired 18 months ago after nearly 30 years of full-time cathedral ministry, first as canon precentor here in Coventry, followed by 20 years as dean, first in Sheffield and then Durham. I loved cathedral ministry, and I owe a great deal to Coventry for having taught me something of the craft of it. It was at Coventry that I learned how far-reaching in society and public life the mission of a cathedral can be, and how cathedrals, through their architecture, their art, their music, their liturgy, their preaching, and the life of their communities, how cathedrals are powerful magnets that increasingly draw worshippers, pilgrims, visitors, and those who are curious about faith from far and wide. Well, we landed in retirement in a rural Northumberland village. The parish church is across the road and is served by an able young priest who is at the same stage in his ministry as I was when I served my own first incumbency in the same diocese which was over 30 years ago. Now, as we re-enter parish life and contribute what we can, we realise how the churches have declined in the three decades that we were largely away from the life of a parish. It's not too much to say that in many places the church is facing real threats to its survival. I'm not only thinking about dwindling congregations, the buildings they have to maintain, the lack of resources with which to do it. I'm wondering, at a more serious level actually, where the next generation of lay leaders is going to come from when multi-parish benefices become ever larger and clergy time is increasingly stretched. When our silver-haired generation dies out, that's to say my silver-haired generation, I say nothing about the people sitting in this congregation, when my silver-haired generation dies out, where are tomorrow's church wardens, treasurers, PCC members, worship leaders, musicians? Where are they going to come from? How long will the present model of parish ministry be sustainable? Now, those who've analysed historical trends over the last century or so tell us that organised religion is in decline in secularised Western Europe. And that's not due to any faulty strategy on the part of the church, or lack of vision, or evangelistic effort, or pastoral care, or social engagement. It's simply a fact on the ground. But the institution of the church finds it extraordinarily hard to admit to decline publicly. Bishops and dioceses devise slogans that relentlessly accentuate the positive. You won't find ads in the back of the Church Times that begin, "We are a declining church, but we are learning to grow smaller gracefully, and we aim to be wise in this generation, and we do not lose heart." You will never see an ad that says that. So how does wisdom speak into this situation? I think she would say a number of things. First of all, speak the truth and don't massage the facts. And if the truth is frightening, which I think it is, don't panic. Do everything you can to understand it and help others understand it, bringing to these difficult questions the critical analytical tools with which reason has endowed you. Expect to find a great deal of complexity in what you discover that will not be susceptible necessarily to the obvious solutions, for instance, programs of evangelism, certainty in theology, throwing money at dwindling churches. Wisdom says, ask yourselves where you detect the work of God in the events and processes of our time. I happen to think that the scriptures are probably less concerned with organized religion and congregational life than we may think, more outward facing in bearing Christ to the world in word and work, more concerned with truth and justice and the weightier matters of the law. Above all, I think wisdom would say, keep hope alive among those who continue to bear witness to God's presence in the ebbs and flows of human life. Pursue goodness, joy, delight. For a church that bears witness to those things that will make us flourish will always carry its own quality of conviction. And in everything, seek the truth and speak it. Be faithful and love what is good. Let me next turn to a matter that's been much on our minds in the past year and indeed in the past week. Last Saturday, the European Union celebrated its 60th birthday. On Wednesday, the Prime Minister triggered the Article 50 process by which this country will leave the European Union. I may as well own up to my feelings of profound sadness here. My mother was a German Jewish war refugee, and I was brought up to think of continental Europe as my home, with Britain as an essential part of it. My mother died just after the referendum last year, scarcely able to take in the realization that the country that had given her a home, protected her from harm, and befriended her, could now walk away from its cultural, historical, and spiritual roots. But we are where we are, and in or out of the EU, we need to continue to be good Europeans, good allies, neighbours, and friends across the North Sea, the Irish Sea, and the English Channel. However, my question tonight is about wisdom and how the Church of England contributed to the debate about our nation's future. Frankly, I was disappointed. We knew after the 2015 election that a referendum would be called and that we would be required to make the biggest political decision of our lifetimes. Some of us begged the Church of England to debate it at its February meeting last year of the Synod, when the referendum campaign was starting. But there was silence, no collective voice from the National Church that could help bring Christian wisdom to this momentous decision. You would think that the future of the nation was a matter of some indifference to the Church of England. And even if the Church was never going to take an official view, though the Church of Scotland, Britain's other national church, did do that, not to try to articulate a Christian voice, not to shine a Christian light on these exceedingly difficult matters, strikes me as a real failure of leadership. It's true that an emergency debate was allowed at the July Synod, but by then it was too late. On Brexit Day last week, the Church of England was silent once again as an official institution. I know there's a time to keep silence, but I really do not think that this was it. So what do we learn? Biblical wisdom literature, as I've said, is not afraid of complexity. Books like Job and Ecclesiastes do not pretend that there are easy answers to the fundamental questions of human existence, such as why is there suffering, why is there love, and where is ultimate meaning to be found. So the Church could have warned us against the perils of binary choices, those fatal either-ors that trap us into thinking that everything must be black and white. It could have said, beware of thinking that all right is on one side or the other. It could have said, try to understand the levels on which we are making sense or trying to of it all, not simply intellectual and cognitive, but emotional as well. So listen to the case made by the other side. Weigh up the evidence, assess the arguments, recognize how feelings come into things when we make these big choices. And the word for this is discernment. The Church is supposed to be good at it. If only it had placed its long spiritual experience of wise discernment at the service of the nation when we needed it, it would have been really good to have had that debate in the General Synod last February. And finally, I want to say something about the matter that is said to threaten to tear the Church apart. Human sexuality, and in particular, same-sex relationships. As we all know, the recent February General Synod decided not to take note of the House of Bishops' report. If I'd still been a member of the Synod, I would have voted with the House of Clergy not to take note, because the report simply didn't do justice to the complexity of human sexuality in the light not only of Christian teaching, but also what we now know from science and social science about our sexualities. The report seemed to bear no relation to the careful listening process that had been set up in every diocese to enable us to hear one another's experience and speak frankly, in a safe place about sexuality. And given that the majority of lay people in the Church now support the view that committed same-sex love is as God-given as heterosexual love, and that the state was right to legislate for gay marriage. The report is not just bad theology, but bad politics. Now, I watched the whole of the synod debate. It seemed to me to be pretty well informed, emotionally intelligent, and respectful. As in the debate about women in the episcopate, the synod can show a remarkable capacity to engage in contentious matters without sacrificing courtesy. Given the wisdom's literature's strong emphasis on listening and using words with care, I think we can be proud of the example our representatives have set, which is why it is such a pity that the synod did not also discuss the EU referendum at the time. But now the bishops have to find a way of bringing back to the church a way forward in its understanding of sexuality that will command consent. And this calls for wisdom of the highest order, because, as we know, there's a real threat to the unity of the Anglican Communion should the Church of England depart, as it would be seen, from the traditional moral disciplines of the Church. Now, I need to tread a bit carefully here. But as with the debate about the European Union, I may as well come clean with you. My belief is that whatever the complexities of the decisions we're called upon to make, we must always do the right thing without fear of the consequences, however hard they may be to face. In other words, we can't let consequentialism dictate the way we make ethical choices. We must not allow the ends to justify or control the means. Wisdom says integrity requires us to do the right thing. Now, there's a big debate about what the right thing is. But it calls for real moral courage, even to ask these questions. I'm in no doubt about what a decision to endorse same-sex marriage and to solemnize or bless it in the church would mean for many Anglicans in Africa, Asia, and South America. I'm also in no doubt how hard this would be for many in our own church to adopt. At the same time, it cannot be right for our church to retain any vestige of discrimination in the way we think, speak, or act. Whether it's inequalities endured by those of colour, by women, or by gay people. So when I speak about acting courageously, I mean with the integrity that is informed by wisdom, and with consciences that have been educated by a long immersion in the faith of the scriptures, nurtured by the sacraments and supported by the prayers of the faithful. Wisdom's presumption in our decision making is that we do not look for easy ways out, nor do we crumple under pressure, nor do we take the pragmatic, politically expedient option. We behave with principle and seek to follow the way of justice and truth. I'm not saying this is ever easy, but I'm saying that anything less is not to act out of Christian wisdom. And it all comes back, therefore, to wise and holy discernment. Now, I believe these three examples, how we respond to a church in decline, how we reflect Christianly on big national decisions like the European Union referendum, how the church considers its position in relation to an issue such as same-sex marriage. I think these three examples show how inescapable the task is of seeking wisdom for and in our church. While we live in times of bewildering complexity, I hesitate to say that previous generations would have found the task of interpreting scriptural wisdom any easier than we do. A church that is semper reformanda, always becoming reformed, can never say to itself that this work is finished. Wisdom ought to make us curious and sharpen our questions. We should expect new light and truth to break forth from God's holy word as we read the ancient text out of our contemporary experience of faith. But let me end by reminding us of the way wisdom is configured in the New Testament. St. Paul tells us that wisdom by itself is not enough. What matters is to cultivate a cross-shaped wisdom that eschews human cleverness and instead looks to the crucified Jesus as both the power of God and the wisdom of God. Paul says that what we must do is to have the mind of Christ. So it's never a bad idea to ask the question when faced with hard choices, what would Jesus do? Always easier to ask than to answer, of course. But to begin to frame the question in that way is to affirm how important it is to ask our questions and do our discernment Christianly, in a Christian way. For if Christ is no less than the incarnate wisdom of God himself, and God's power and wisdom are found not in the end in human knowledge or achievement, but in Christ crucified, where else can we possibly go? Especially as we prepare to celebrate his passion and resurrection in the holy week of our salvation that will soon be upon us.